Hello and welcome to the CTO series, a collection of interviews with tech leaders from some of Australia's biggest and fastest growing businesses, hosted by Terem CEO Scott Middleton. Today's conversation is with Doug Rathbone, who is the CTO at Airtasker. In this episode, Scott and Doug discuss how to define a culture of accountability and build expectations around outcomes, not outputs, in order to empower product teams. Here's Scott.
So today we're going to be talking about scaling empowered engineering teams, puppy dogs and wolves, and it'll be interesting to unpack what that means with Doug. This is part of our Aussie and New Zealand CTO tech chats, where we're going through chatting to CTOs and engineering leaders from around Australia and New Zealand, listening to what they're going through, listening to the stories, experience, insights that they can share. And I'm just going to give a quick background on Terem. So we're a tech product development and strategy firm. We've got a presence across ANZ, California. And look, we just love working on tech products, whether it's in product management and strategy, or whether we're getting stuck into the detail of a DevOps or engineering problem. We just love all aspects of it. I'm Scott. I'm the CEO and founder of Terem. I've been involved in north of 65, 70 major product launches of all shapes and sizes, from startups to government, enterprise, scaled up tech companies. It's just what I love. And actually, there's a really common interest outside of work that Doug and I have discovered we've got, which is American barbecue. I'll quickly introduce Doug, and then I think we may change topic today and go down the American barbecue route if everyone wants us to. But no, we'll stick with what we're doing. But so Doug, just on a serious note, engineering leader, formerly at Amazon, has joined Airtasker as CTO, and really has some interesting stories to share around what empowerment means. You know, it's a word that gets thrown around a lot, but what does that mean? How do you embed it in an organization? And what does it look like when it's working, not working? We're going to be covering a whole bunch of that today. But just before we do that, you know, about 5-10 minutes ago, Doug and I were talking about American barbecue. I think it's a great thing to like share a few personal stories, get to know the person behind the technologist. Doug, American barbecue. So we're talking about brisket before, which we've got a common interest in, and we're saying you're doing pellet smoking. Just what got you into American barbecue? Why do you love it?
Outside of the fact that I think brisket and smoked ribs make for a pretty delicious meal, I think it for me, so I lived with my wife and our son in Seattle for about 7 years or so. When my son was born, the American equivalent of kind of mother's group, they call it PEPS in the US. We had another member on that father who had a barbecue joint. And it turns out that when you're on maternity or paternity leave and looking for something to do, tending to a smoker is kind of quite similar to tending to a baby in terms of the amount of love and touch points throughout the day. So he introduced me to barbecue, and we kind of went down a bit of a rabbit hole while I was on my paternity leave, and then definitely continued the love after that. That's definitely been a habit that stuck, and it's also brought me back home as well. I brought my smoker with me when I moved back from the States. Had to do a bunch of backyard electrical engineering to make it work on 240 volts because it's a pellet grill. But we're back in the game and happy to spread the joy of barbecue to anyone who will come around and visit.
We have to cut ourselves short because this one
we've
gone for forever. There's so many different, but we'll let's get into what we're here to talk about, which is we caught up a while back. We were talking about the journey that you've gone through at Airtasker. Just before we get into it, I'd love you to set the scene a little bit around maybe Airtasker when you the engineering organization when you joined, just what, you know, what it looked like, number of people, kinds of practices, and then we can, you know, really dig into this journey of empowerment and what that looks like.
Totally. We can jump into that, but I think it's important to maybe set some background context. So that, like, then I can explain how I kind of perceived Airtasker in terms of the opportunity when I joined, and then also like some of the things I saw, and also the opportunities to take some of that learning. So as Scott said, I've been in engineering for about 20 years or so, been in engineering leadership for about 10 or 12. And I've had a couple of different lives along that journey. So I started kind of building websites pre.com boom, and then did a stint working a couple of years in agencies, did some enterprise software development for a number of years before moving over to work in the States at Amazon. And at Amazon, I also had three separate roles. So I first joined and was working on teams that were responsible for parts of the seller experience in the third-party marketplace for Amazon.com. So like actually where you buy things from. That's incredible in terms of like the scale, but also the maturity of that organization. Amazon's been doing e-commerce for a while. They've kind of got a lot of that pretty down pat, but at the same time, like the volume of transactions, I think was about, it was over $1 billion a month when I left. And that means that you're thinking around trade-offs and decisions. And also like when you have an operational outage, like you really see the odometer of dollar signs going in your head, and that makes you kind of think about decisions in a certain way. I then went and worked about 4 years in AWS, where I was responsible for building a couple of products within the DevTool space. So AWS CodeStar, and being heavily involved in code commit and code build. And that's interesting because AWS is really just a lots and lots of separate products, but they're all kind of trying to vie for different levels of attention from customers. But at the same time, they're trying to find their own product market fit depending on what they're doing. So again, like for me as an engineering leader, you're really learning about product market fit, product strategy, and having to think a little bit more creatively around more than just building and operating systems, which is kind of interesting.
And Doug, what was the team size like with one of those products that you're on? Is it the two pizza thing? So you had like a two pizza kind of engineering team, and you're just shipping, talking to customers?
I mean, that's exactly right. I think one of the things that Amazon has done quite well is a lot of its organizational design principles. And I do think that they've been quite forming for me. But as Scott just mentioned, this concept of a two pizza team exists at Amazon, where generally when you have a new idea or a new product, you fund a small team and you give them a lot of autonomy to try and find their way and be successful in a lot of ways, like a small startup. Amazon's a giant company, but in some ways the magic is the fact that they create this kind of environment. So my time at AWS, we started with a team of about five, and I think by the time I left there was about 40 in my product space. But I think the way it works is those are just continually growing and splitting and growing and splitting. And then as product verticals kind of split off, they do the same. So it's kind of like Coral in a lot of ways. I think that the lessons I took there are also kind of formative for me in terms of just that product strategy thinking. And then before joining Airtasker, I looked after video news and entertainment for Alexa. Which, for anyone who's got an Echo device that has a screen, it's kind of a new product type in terms of physical product, because you're trying to figure out how to take advantage of a virtual assistant that also has a screen, which is a bit of a new concept in the world of tech these days. So when I moved back to Australia and was looking for roles that were going, happening in terms of senior leadership positions, but also ones that had interesting product elements to them, Airtasker, I think, was really attractive for a number of reasons. And I think that they're also, in some ways, they're like challenges and opportunities wrapped up together. So Airtasker is about 10 years old as a company, and founded as the founder's paying a digital agency to build a Ruby on Rails website and a mobile app. And then over the years that grew as the company grew and went from success to success. And where we find ourselves now is we have about 150 employees and about 60 of them are engineering staff, 70-ish once you include management. And we're rapidly growing, we're a profitable business. But in that journey, I think, is wrapped up a lot of that that thinking around being scrappy and running fast, heavy experimentation. And that means that I think a lot of the muscle the organization had at the time that I joined was really around initiatives and feature builds and making sure the organization is structured to, successfully discover and then execute against those features or those product surface areas. And then go to market and grow those features, but not a whole heap of maturity had been placed into the organizational design around, feeding and watering the features we already have, both from a product standpoint as well as from an operational and engineering excellence standpoint. So when I joined, I think we were about I'm the fourth generation of engineering. That has come through Airtasker. Been quite fortunate that over the years we've had a number of folks join from what you'd call tier one engineering companies, maybe such as the Googles and the Atlassians and the Amazons. So you have a lot of these core ingredients, and I think a lot of scale up businesses see this, where they're reaching a point where they're no longer a small. As Scott said before about Amazon, they're no longer a single two pizza team. And they have a fair amount of product surface area that needs care and love and maintenance, but also needs the right structure and the right kind of rituals within the business to just continually move everything forward and raise the tide for all boats. So that's I think the kind of setting that I came into is they had a decent and growing engineering organization with good maturity, a profitable business. So in a lot of ways, we're actually fortunate to be able to start to think long-term and really think about not just the trade-offs around getting things to market, but then also long-term scaling complexities, operational concerns, and all those other good things that come from actually running a product or a service after you ship it. And I think that's what I'd love to talk more about today is just that journey we've been on over the last year or so since I joined at really getting some of those fundamentals in place that you may see at contemporary product companies that are a little bit bigger than ours as we've gone on that transition. And I think wrapped up in that also is how we empower engineers and I think by extension other folks outside of the product management function to actually be more empowered and get more involved in the growth of the business and the health of their team.
And when you say you good at kind of doing the discovery on initiatives and then executing on them, could you just talk through that a bit more detail, like give it a bit of color?
Sure. So like, I think if you imagine, if we just paint an imaginary scenario, I think like, if you and I went to start a business tomorrow, Scott, we'd probably start building a website or an app if we were to build a digital product. And we'd be building features that maybe customers are giving us feedback that they need or they like.
I was hoping we were going to start a barbecue business, but...
As long as you're getting that customer feedback and package on the customer needs, which barbecue is all about. If we were to do that, I think we would probably, launch our website on some hosting platform that allowed it to have, limited operational requirements. Mm. Maybe if I was your tech co-founder, I'd set up continuous integration and deployment so that it was really easy for us to just continually get changes out.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, we probably built so many features that, maybe there's some security issues with a dependency that we were using on one feature we built last year.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's a product feature that we launched. It didn't really get too much adoption. And maybe it's actually wrapped up in a bit of technical debt if we think about how it contributes.
And you're kind of maintaining it and it's just,
yeah. And I think a lot of there's many terms that people use for this. Some people call it product debt, but you know, there's a number of these key challenges you start to have once you just have a certain amount of product surface area and the systems that power it behind that running in a business.
Yeah.
And if we think about that journey, you know, maybe you and I as co-founders would be continually trying to figure out what it is that we need to build next, or what area of our product do we need to really focus on to drive the next phase of our growth.
Yeah.
And I think one of the challenges is trying to build in the kind of muscle within the organization to do multiple things at once, to really kind of tap our heads and rub our bellies at the same time.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, you know, you can be really laser focused on an area that is driving growth, but there needs to be a portion of the business who's keeping the lights on and feeding and watering all the other things that make up your product or your business. And in engineering, I think, and also in product, there is this kind of gravitational pull to always move towards what's new. And you really need to kind of be intentional about trying to create space to look after all of the things. But I think from an empowerment standpoint, it also means that there may be product surface areas that haven't driven kind of exponential growth, but if you continue to tweak them, you may unlock that next phase. And again, creating that environment where the teams who are responsible for that surface area can experiment and innovate outside of the core focus of the business.
And how there's a couple of ways that I kind of want to go there. A really interesting one on this topic of empowerment is I see a lot of companies that in that situation that you're describing, where they go, we need more process, and you slap on like safe or release trains, and no, we got to get control of it now because we're a serious business and we need to do serious things where we're going to make sure that, you know, like we've got the right amount of allocation to security or the right amount of this, and it's all going to come through Doug or like a few key people who are going to sign. I see that often happen at this stage, but it sounds to me like you've gone a different kind of direction with that.
It's a good question, because I think you can come at the problem from a couple of different angles.
Yeah.
And the journey that I've been on with our product leaders and engineering leaders at Airtasker over the last year, we've tried to break it into a bit more of a kind of tractable set of kind of milestones we want to achieve. But I think for me, it really breaks down into kind of three key areas. And I think there's a little bit of process in each of them.
Yeah.
But I think you can, as long as you understand the principles, you can figure out how much process you do or don't need based on the team's needs and the team's maturity. So the first I'd say is like team structure and customer or system ownership. So making sure that you are able to define groups of humans within your organization who are thinking about customer problems, whether it's journeys. At Airtasker, we've chosen vertical slices of our product.
Yeah.
And then in that, defining the key customers of that either that journey or that slice of the product and the systems that back them. So that's, I think, component one, which we can talk about in a little bit.
And what do you mean by vertical? Just like when you say vertical?
Yeah, right. Like a vertical slice of a product may be everything from the web page that customers are interacting with, the APIs that sit behind that, any of the data tier or backend systems that power that feature or that set of features.
Yeah.
Maybe like I think from an engineering standpoint, if you think about microservices architecture, and I explain a little bit more where Airtasker is at today, we have about 29 different microservices and systems. So when we talk about those vertical slices, some teams will own one or a couple of those systems. And they'll also own, from an accountability standpoint, the customer experience when using them, the key metrics associated to success in that part of the product, the long-term roadmap and thinking behind that. So really just defining a kind of boundary of ownership for yeah. that group of humans. Yeah. And I'm not just talking about engineers. I'm talking about a cross-functional team.
Yeah, yeah.
In some ways, similar to, I think, the me saying that I found Amazon formative. You know, we're kind of thinking about almost like small businesses and what they're doing to grow their business.
Sorry, and so I interrupted you. You were doing the then you were going to the next.
So
number one was teams and structures, I think, and then you were doing number two.
Then I think like planning rituals and by extension capital allocation.
Yep.
So at Airtasker, we've decided to plan on a 6-monthly basis. We take OKRs over that 6-monthly basis. I know that many companies take OKRs and plan over a 3-month cycle. For us, at 6 months. Because we found that to be a little bit easier in terms of planning overhead. So mm-hmm. coming back to your question around process, trying to focus more on the iteration throughout that cycle versus big changes in direction, and then by extension of that planning process, putting in place a way for teams to think about capital allocation off the back of that for the business. So how many engineers, product leaders, designers do you have, and how many do you need? What would your plan look like if you had an additional couple of people? What would it look like if you had one or two less? And really just thinking about it from a, as I said before, like a small business, if you were thinking about growth within that space. So that's the second kind of pillar that I'd say is like the planning rituals and thinking about, all of the things that go into ultimately what is capital allocation in the business. So that's that second pillar. And then the third one is really just getting clear across the business around what ownership and accountability looks like. So, we have key customer metrics that we're thinking about as a company and growth metrics that we're thinking about as a company, but then also at a team level, What key metrics does a team use to measure success? And ultimately, who is responsible for ensuring that those metrics are moving in the right direction? And I think there's that other piece around ownership and accountability, which is kind of interesting because I can talk a little bit about how Airtasker works, but we do have this concept of a Hydra where our cross-functional teams do have almost mini POCs from each function, so design, engineering leader, and a product leader. On smaller teams, they may just be the designer, the one engineer, and the product person. However, we have said that ultimately one person is that tiebreaker and kind of owner of the outcomes for that team. So they're the three pillars that I think we've really tried to work through. So we can talk a little more about how we've gone about that, but it really is that team structure and customer and system ownership, planning rituals and capital allocation, and then ownership and accountability, and all of the things that that kind of map up into those pillars.
And when we were talking about doing this session, you said, I want to talk about puppies and wolves. And I was like, what? where does that concept fit in what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think this is really wrapped up in, I think some of my leadership philosophy around just around ownership and accountability. And I think this kind of overlays a lot of these pillars that we put in place at Airtasker. But it really comes back to, for me, and this is a bit of a funny story or anecdote here, is that early in my time as an engineering leader, I found myself one Sunday afternoon watching, I think it was Discovery Channel, and they had this episode on I think it was Timberwolves, and it was talking about how wolves and dogs are different, and ultimately they made a bunch of judgments around like the differences between animals, and like I'm definitely not a dog or a wolf expert, so don't quote me on any of these things. But I think the way they defined dogs was that because they're constantly fed and watered and taken out to do their business, they cap out in maturity at about the age of 2 or 3. They're really toddlers in terms of the cognitive abilities they build and like how they think about themselves. Whereas you compare them to wolves, you know, wolves are apex predators. You know, they're constantly out there. They hunt in packs. They work as a group, and they survive. You know, and I think I reflect on that in engineering as a vertical, or software development as a vertical, and the fact that historically many software engineering jobs, even today, or many software developers are placed in a role where they're given requirements and they're the delivery portion of someone else's vision, or they're delivering on someone else's initiative. And that leads to, you know, similar to puppy dogs, it leads to a little bit of atrophy in terms of like critical thinking around trade-offs, really understanding why you're building something. And because of that, if there are any other kind of overlaps between your technical design and the business problem that would allow you to actually have more impact with what you're doing, or to, you know, provide a little bit more input. And like, I think that while I'm kind of using both ends of the extreme there, I think a lot of engineers within product teams would argue that they have opinions on lots of things. I think one of the missing ingredients there of kind of that puppy dog versus wolf shift is the point where you're actually putting engineers or other leaders from other functions, maybe it's design or marketing, in a position where they're responsible for making sure that the team or the product or the initiative is successful. And that environment alone really, you know, shapes how they think about, you know, the actual engineering element of what they're delivering. I think I see some kind of parallels here between, you know, the kind of trope that sometimes gets used around gold plating and how engineers like to gold plate. And in some ways I see that potentially being a symptom of this kind of puppy dog versus wolf thinking, where, you know, if you can only control what your system design or feature design looks like, then you focus a lot of energy on that. And that feels like the most important thing that's going on in your world. Whereas I think as the second you kind of maybe asked an engineering leader to own a customer metric and to report on it regularly and kind of talk about how what the team is doing contributes to moving that in the right direction, all of a sudden the idea of shipping something scrappy and iterating has a completely different viewpoint on it, because or the way you think about it becomes more around, okay, if I need to get something out to customers, but then also I need to be aware about the operational ownership long term of this thing. If I'm making trade-offs, it's not so much about shipping something that is, you know, filled with technical debt. It's more around how do you do both of those things in tension, and what is the right level of engineering investment versus getting things out to customers quickly. And I think in there is a lot of the lessons around how you can take engineers and build them into leaders very rapidly.
Going back to your kind of three, you know, your team structure, process, and then the ownership thing, and thinking about this concept of puppies and wolves, how do you you know, not everyone can just be thrown into like, right, tell me how much capital you need, tell me what your goals are, you've got responsibility for that system, and it's yours, you own it now, go, you know, like, go.
Yeah,
like how do you, that, you know, and it's not that people aren't capable of that. I'm not definitely not saying that. It's more what I have definitely observed is often someone has to work through it. And then once they've worked through it a few times, they get in the rhythm, like, and often it sometimes with someone more, let's say, getting started in their career, it's about building them up with the right tools, because they often want to, you know, they got the energy, they want to grab it. And then maybe with people who are a bit more mid-career, it might be to your point around engineers being given like, here's a requirements, go build it for me. It's sometimes around maybe shaping out some of the previous things they've been taught not to do. So like, no, don't go and have a fight with the product manager, because you'll just get like, you're going to have a bad time. Whereas basically in the environment you're talking about of wolves, you're like, no, like, you know, you own this thing. Go and, like, if you need extra people, if you think you do need gold plating, or if you want to do big shortcuts, you got to go have that discussion. And it tends not to be a fight in a good culture, right? So I guess I'm curious, like, how do you get this going? And once you do have it going, how do you bring people on the journey? Because new starters aren't just going to drop in and just be like, cool, I got it, I'm away.
Yeah, it's a good question, because we've just talked kind of like high level, and we've also talked about a bunch of different concepts, so mapping them together I think makes sense, because we're just dropping a lot of context on people. One of the things I'd call out is empowerment doesn't necessarily mean autonomy. And like, I think from a leadership viewpoint, I think when we talk about those three pillars, so like team structure and customer and system ownership, planning, rituals, and then ownership and accountability, actually defining in some ways like the operating system for the company, like the planning cycle. What does it look like? What are the inputs that a team needs to produce? So we create templates that teams have to fill out for defining, okay, what is their plan for the next 6 months? What are the things we're asking for them? Okay, if we think about the initiatives they're delivering, what are the key metrics that they're moving, or what are the key results they're targeting towards? Similarly, I think if we think about ongoing, what kind of rituals do you have in place to check in with teams? Almost similarly to how you would do end of sprint, if you're doing agile end of sprint demos, what are you doing to think about the team's progress on a regular basis? So for us, like, there has been a number of those tools that we've put in place. So if we think about a planning cycle beginning to end at Airtasker today, and I would caveat to say that we're on this journey still today. So it's around us rapidly getting to that place of empowerment. And then I think as an extension, autonomy. So we've got a 6 month planning process, about 6 to 8 weeks out of the beginning of that 6 month period. We start working with teams on what their key problems are in their area, and have them write, fill out a template that really defines what their key opportunities and challenges are. Do a little bit of a state of the union on like the health of their team and their systems. So how's the product going? How are the people feeling in terms of, you know, if you've had anyone join or enter and leave, and kind of what morale is looking like, and then the operational health of your systems. So, you know, what is the latency that your systems are, your customers are currently experiencing? You know, what's your level of availability in terms of the previous period? And, you know, if you think about a template where you were to fill out all of those areas in a bit more of a narrative form, you get a little bit of a picture of, okay, this is how a team is thinking about their current state and what they want to do next. And doing a review of that allows you to then get a good sense of, to your point, Scott, you know, which teams need the most guidance. And if you think about that 6 to 8 weeks in the lead up to the beginning of a 6 month period, we call them semesters, you know, you have time to then work with the team and iterate on their plan. Either you're giving them feedback around their plan and saying, hey, like, is this opportunity really as big as you think it is? Or maybe you're giving them feedback and you're saying, hey, it looks like your operational health is not great. Your plan doesn't seem to address that in the next semester. So what are you planning to do to address that? Alternately, if you have a very junior team, it might mean you realize, hey, like, we need to workshop this together and really, like, maybe there's some opportunities where you need someone to do some data analysis for you. Or maybe you just need a more senior leader to really work through your observations on what the customer problems and validate whether they're actually true, or whether you kind of misread what you're either hearing from customers or some of the funnel completion data you might have on a feature.
Yeah.
And I think that's again, it's like when we talk about the planning rituals, it's the mechanism that allows those conversations to happen. And that's where you can kind of, as a leader also, shift between whether you're kind of in audit mode or consultation mode, versus, hey, I actually need to get in and kind of lay the groundwork with you in the trenches.
You know, it's really interesting you say that, Doug, because one of my next question is going to be, or kind of observation, is what you're describing to me really sounds like a style where you're not with each team, you're evaluating the leadership style and the activities that you're going to take with that team. There might be a team where they are autonomous because they've been working with you and in the process for a while, and they've got a mature part of your product portfolio, and you just kind of leave them to it because they know what they're doing. And then there might be another team, maybe they're experienced people, but they're dealing with a new product or something like that, where you've really got to, you know, roll the sleeves up and work with them on what does the plan look like? What are you going to do? No, we've got to get deeper on that. So is that kind of a fair observation of what you're describing?
Yeah, I think this so when we talk about those pillars and like the planning, that we've got the team structure, where we'd say teams understand that they own a customer problem and they own some systems off the back of them. And then the planning ritual just allows you to say, like, how are they going at addressing that problem? This team owns a space. What's the level of maturity going on there? And what's my involvement there? Is it really just to get out of their way and kind of give them resources and support? Is it to, as you were saying, lean in and kind of define some of that early product strategy because it's a new surface area?
And there's a good question here from Chris, which says, do you track longitudinally across your state of the unions every 6 months to identify, you know, growth or progress? Or do you just kind of each time just clean the slate and just go like, well, everything's up in the air?
I think there's probably like two parts to that question. One is, yeah, at a company level. So while we're not a huge company, 150 people, you still have to make sure that everyone's kind of moving as one. And throughout that planning process, you know, we do end that planning process with a set of company objectives and key results, team objectives and key results that map up to those in a lot of ways. But at the same time, a number of teams will have key results and initiatives going in their coming semester, which kind of sit off to the side, but maybe are just as important, but they're not like contributing to growth or whatever it might be that's that company objective. Mm. And I think that's where, come back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier around the fact that you get to that size as a company where you need to make sure that everyone's moving towards the key kind of outcomes that the company's focused on. But these kind of side needs within the business need continual investment in. And that's where I think the team level structure around a customer problem allows you to then create that kind of small business unit that's looking after both of those things at the same time in tension.
Now, there's another good question from Chris that Chris asked earlier that I think kind of ties in well here, which is, how do you then unpack the how to allocate the budgets to these? And that's like, you know, you were talking before about as you scale, you start having things around, well, actually, do we need to sunset this feature? Or do we need to put some more security rigor into this feature? Or, you know, have we just got to do some plain old refactoring to get rid of some tech debt to set us up for whatever the future might bring because we hacked something together? Do you, when you're talking about empowerment, is that something like, is it a one size fits all where everyone's got to have 20% allocated to refactoring and security? Or do you kind of leave it on the teams and maybe as part of those templates, they've got to explain?
That's a good question. So if we think about how we plan and the areas within that template that teams need to fill out, I mentioned before, there's an element there around operational health. So we have like product health, team health and morale, and then kind of operational health. And teams, both before they start their semester as well as ongoing throughout that 6 monthly process as we check in with them, because we check in monthly, we can talk about that in a little bit. We ask them to account for what percentage of time they spend in a couple of different areas. So what percentage of your time are you spending on product work what percentage of your time are you spending on operations? Within engineering at Airtasker, I like to split out the way we measure that in three separate ways. So we think about mandatory operations is things like security or compliance or GDPR or something like that. You've got proactive operations, which maybe is thinking about scaling work, or it might be addressing some technical debt that's starting to slow you down. And then reactive operations is things like on-call or getting paged or an outage and things like that. And we ask teams to report on where they spend their time. And again, this is kind of a bit of a mechanism where by asking the team to report on these things, teams have built very rapidly the muscles to be able to say, okay, like we've been recording where we spend our time, and we spend, you know, one team we were looking at a couple of months ago, we realized that they're spending 50% of their time on operations. And that immediately triggered a discussion between myself and the engineering leaders in that space around, okay, in your plan, what are you doing to make sure that that number is going down over the next semester? So I think, you know, when we talk about allocating resources, again, like these kind of planning rituals allow us to have those touch points that then trigger those conversations. We talked about planning and like the product direction kind of element, but I think engineering wise as well, this is an example where if you say to a team, hey, like where are you spending your time on engineering capacity, even just the act of measuring it has made a lot of our engineers go, hey, like I didn't realize that, you know, we're solving tickets for this part of our product that, you know we're solving about two of these a week, and it's taking up a day or two of our time on every week. Now that I know that, maybe we should try and do something about that.
Doug, you're talking magic to me. I'm always a strong advocate of tracking time for this exact reason. If you don't know where your time's going, how can you get better? Like, and often when I see like disasters happening or situations where we've never got enough time to build new things, or like I'm frustrated because every time we plan something, it never happened, you know, like the sprint never gets completed, and you're like, where's your time going? Oh, I don't know. Well, how can anyone help a team, and how can the team help themselves if you don't know where the problem is? Because sometimes it might be, oh, the problem's here. Oh, well, you know, let's just allocate, like there's someone, we can get someone to come and help you to just fix that in 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden you've got free time. Like why I'm a big advocate for it.
It's kind of interesting. I think that's the change between this kind of sense of kind of learned helplessness or powerlessness shifting to actually understanding the problem. And you mentioned earlier, you know, when people talk about process, it's a little bit of a dirty word. And I'd say like time measurement in engineering teams is one of those
triggers. Oh, yeah.
The kind of, are you getting me to fill out TPS reports kind of trope? But I think that's been an interesting journey for us to go on as well, where, you know, if we're asking teams to account for where they're spending their time, some teams have decided to measure their time in using certain tools. Mm. I think we have very rapidly developed a central place where we track roadmaps and where people are spending their time, broken down by initiative and operations. It's really like a glorified Excel spreadsheet for each team that's got a couple of macros applied to it. And again, we've just been trying to keep it as lightweight as possible. But the outcome is that, coming back to Chris's question around, you know, like, how do you allocate resources? One, I think as an engineering leader, it's sometimes hard. You have blind spots around where resources need to be allocated. But then also teams themselves are often, you know, really focused on a new feature, or they're really focused on a problem that might not represent 100% of where they're spending their time, especially when it comes to things that are slowing you down.
Yeah.
You know, like I think it's easier for a team to say, hey, we're feeling really stretched. We can't do that as quickly as you need it. And then when you actually kind of work backwards from, well, where are you spending your time, and realize that maybe that team has a high operational load, or they spend a lot of their time doing things repeatedly that could be automated. just the touch point of making sure that you know, by having them produce an artifact that they know leadership is going to review, in a lot of ways that itself triggers some really great discussions and then actions off the back of that.
I definitely have seen, even as like, you know, looking over what's happening on a set of teams or whatever, something I've certainly seen is that if you're not aware of, it's good to be aware of where time isn't going as well. Because I can look, you know, especially it almost always happens coming into a release. Oh, we're just going to cut out, like, I always, my alarm bells fly off and someone's like, oh, we've just stopped doing that thing because we're just really focused on shipping a particular feature, or we've got to hit our release date. And I think, all right, well, that means that we've really got to begin the process now of allowing time for that thing that we're skipping proper pipelines for this particular feature, and we're just going to deploy straight to straight to the server is an often heard one. And you go, all right, well, what we need to do from a planning point of view then is make sure that after that release, there's no pressure on to ship new features, because we're going to have to fix that issue, or it's just going to get worse in the future. I think it's good to know that, like, well, we're not putting time in operation, so I'm incurring a debt that I'm going to have to pay down in the future potentially.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we find interesting on that similar thread around trade-offs that happen, you know, whether it be from scope creep or whether it be from, you know, feature late in its release where you're, you know, trying to figure out whether it actually meets the quality bar or whatever it might be. You know, I think by moving to a model where teams are asked continually to really account for all of what's going on in their space, as well as the health of their customer metrics and the health of the systems or customer experiences they own,
yeah,
it often then again allows them to have the tools to then you know, have a meaningful discussion around the trade-offs that come off the back of some of those scope creep discussions or anything like that.
Yeah.
So yeah. You know, you're saying, like, a team may say, we're really focused on this, so we can't work on, we're really focused on this new feature A, so feature B that we shipped last month can't get the work that we committed to all done. Even being able to have that discussion in the heat of battle when everyone's really excited about making sure that new feature gets out the door and to customers. Yeah. It really, in some ways, also as a leader, I think allows the teams to highlight the blind spots that you and anyone else involved in those decisions
might have,
has lost objectivity on, right?
Yeah.
So those artifacts kind of work for teams as well as leaders there around just being that touch point. And we see that a lot. So at Airtasker, once we've shipped into or started our semester, we do have a monthly product review, which again has a template that teams are filling out. That's kind of like in a similar way. It's a continuation of their planning artifact, where it is kind of defining what their team, again, we do a lot of repetition. It's like what their team charter is and what their key metrics are, the state of their business. And you know what they've shipped this month, what their key metrics are telling them, any customer anecdotes that might exist in their space, operational health, et cetera. And again, that kind of that discipline of just, you know, capturing that 360 degree view on a regular basis allows teams to kind of think backwards from that artifact creation. So even if they're not thinking about all parts of their business, that artifact in some ways forces them to take stock. But then also it allows all of the members of a team outside of just product to kind of be thinking about them as well. So I think the original topic we were talking about today was around empowering engineering teams and engineering leaders.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, where the level playing field comes in, because if a team is continually reporting about all parts of their business, if we termed it that, operational health and team morale is a part of that. And you know, if you have engineers produce the availability metrics or the percentage of time they've spent on operations versus product versus whatever it might be. Again, that itself often triggers some conversations within the team that allows the team to build a lot of trust, but also kind of have alignment around what trade-offs can and can't be made going into the next month.
There's a good anecdote I can share on that one where it was a light bulb around this for me with sharing. I started sharing user metrics. This is a while ago. I used to kind of go like, I'll just worry about it and get the engineers to do the features. And then I started sharing the usage metrics. And one of the engineers on the team was really, really data-driven. So like when he started seeing it, he got so excited and would every day come in with ways to move the metrics we're looking at. And he was like really obsessed with them, but it really showed me the power of like, by including people, they can start to be empowered to take ownership of those things.
And no, they're the exact behaviors, I think, that really comes out of that kind of empowerment process. And a lot of it is just around creating that framework for those conversations to happen. Or in your case, the engineer having the ability to see into the business metrics on a regular basis and understand why it is that they're doing what they're doing and how they might contribute.
Yeah. And there'd be questions like, hey, did that feature I shipped, did it move the every day? It was really good. We've only got a couple of minutes left. So what I want to do is, A, if there's any kind of questions from the people on the webinar with us, and I might kick, like while they're kind of thinking if there's any questions they want to ask you, Doug, I kind of want to kick one off, which I've been dying to ask, but I've held off. How are you doing your tooling? Is everyone on some mammoth like Jira, Trello, Asana, I don't know, like board, or does each team get to pick and really your tooling's like spreadsheets and templates?
So tooling wise, from a software engineering stack, we do have a number of standard patterns and practices, both I think at the system level, we have a standard set of, we call them service chassis. So it's kind of like a starter pack
that
a new team can take and then build a microservice with. We have standardized tooling around CI/CD. So that means that teams, once they've taken that service chassis, are able to then quickly deploy it and kind of start that iteration process. For us, we use Circle CI. For our CI/CD.
Yep.
And then we do have a number of patterns and practices and frameworks, like software engineering frameworks, as well as design patterns that have been documented within the business that teams can leverage. And I think one of the interesting things here is kind of similar to this empowerment piece is we haven't said to teams, you have to write things in our primary languages. So for us, we use Java and Kotlin for a lot of our microservices. We use Ruby on Rails for a lot of our websites and React on the front end. But we haven't said to teams, you have to do this. Some teams have built Python microservices and we have a service chassis that allows them to do that. But I think what we have seen is that by creating, in some ways, front running some of that kind of structure and that standard tooling best practice, the gravitational pull of, hey, do I really want to worry about that stuff? Or should I just use the commonly used approach?
It's almost like user experience by making it so like, it's like, you know, using an Uber or something. It's so easy to use that you're just going to tap the button.
Yeah. and I think we've got a long way to go there, but we actually do have a team in our platform operations group that is called Engineering Empowerment, and they're tasked with, you know, making sure that we're all shipping a little bit faster.
I've seen a couple of teams like Twitch has one, for instance, that does the same thing. It's like the developer experience.
And there's many different ways that you can help the rest of the organization run fast, but just by continually defining those kind of well-trodden paths, what we tend to see is that people, you know, take the easy route. And I think it's coming back to that team structure and customer and system ownership piece, is that if you know that you have customers that need a piece of functionality, it becomes less around wanting to pick whatever the hot framework is, and really around that core kind of product development and the engineering
elements of that. Solving the problem.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, cool. Yeah, that was my big one around what, but what about your task management and your process management? Does everyone get to do their own thing and just report back in those monthly reports? Or are you kind of like tracking everyone's tasks that they're closing off each sprint?
So in terms of like agile planning tooling, we do use Jira internally. Most teams use it. I'd say 95% of teams use Jira. Some teams do use Trello, but again, I think that the standard practice just kind of pulls people in. We also, for our on-call, we use OpsGenie, which plugs in pretty well with Jira. Yeah. And again, that kind of the simplicity of taking an operational incident and moving it into a ticket that a team can then work on means that over time, I think everyone's just kind
it's easier to
easy path because passing around URLs and having to share that context live slows people down. So whatever the easiest path is tends to lead to people adopting it.
We got to wrap up. Thank you so much, Doug, for spending time with us, telling us about your journey at Airtasker, helping me understand the dogs and the puppies and wolf situation. But no, honestly, it's been great. I've loved having you. Thank you for spending the time, and thanks to everyone that's joined us.
You've been listening to Terram CEO Scott Middleton talking with Airtasker CTO Doug Rathbone about all things tech leadership. Terram is a product development firm that has helped some of Australia's biggest organisations like Qantas, QBE, Immutable and many government agencies develop and deliver high-quality digital products. If you'd like to learn more about the work that we do, visit terram.tech or connect with us on LinkedIn from the links in the episode description. Subscribe to this podcast now to make sure you catch the next installment in the series where Scott talks to the VP of Engineering at Octopus Deploy about scaling their team 120% in just 7 months. Thanks for listening.